don't want to carry the weight for the entire newsroom. And often when you're the only one, and in a lot of newsrooms in the 70s and 80s, I was the only one. And for that organization, often the first one. So you have to represent everything from the United States down to Tierra del Fuego. You have to be the guy, the Latino whisperer, who explains everything, contextualizes everything, translates everything. It's a pain in the ass.
Coming up on In Contrast, journalist Ray Suarez. I am Milan Stavans. In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio and Quixote Productions. In his distinguished career in broadcast journalism, Ray Suarez has reported for National Public Radio, PBS NewsHour, CNN, and most recently Al Jazeera. He's the author of three books, including Latino Americans, The 500-Year Legacy That Shaped a Nation. Suarez is currently a visiting professor in American Studies at Amherst College. Ray, I want to start with a broad question. I want to ask you if you believe that once ethnicity or national background or gender ultimately shape the way one reports a piece of news.
It shouldn't, I guess, in an ideal world, but I'm sure inevitably it does. It shouldn't really change the facts at the core of the story. The story is what it is. I think it's more the grace notes, the secret sauce, the things that a woman might notice that a man wouldn't, the things a black reporter would notice that a white reporter wouldn't, and so on. It's the little extras, the little things that are even hard to quantify that you bring to a story. From Martian lands, an Earthling reporter should be able to cover them, and the story is pretty much the story.
In that seasoning, those little details, should they be clear, obvious, even if they are little, or should they be invisible and yet felt?
I guess context matters. When I was a reporter in Chicago, it was a commonplace when the seasons changed to do stories on the first hot day, the first really cold day, the first big snowstorm. And one time I was run out the door to do the first really hot day. The weatherman was surprised. It was suddenly in the 90s. And there I was. And instead of doing the standard Oak Street Beach, Gold Coast, blondes on the lakefront story, I went to Humboldt Park, which is a couple of miles from the lake, longtime home of Puerto Rican Chicago, and interviewed a piragua man, a man making shaved ice with various flavored syrups. And this is something that many Chicagoans would have no idea even existed, and yet very much part of a hot day story in the city of Chicago. Was I noticing something special that only a Puerto Rican reporter would know, bringing special knowledge in? Well, you know, maybe. But what I was really doing was trying to give a bigger slice of the life that's being lived in a community to a broadcast audience that was being drawn from nine different counties. So sure, give them the lakefront, give them the crowded beach and the bikini blondes, but also give them the piragua man. And I think that's the little something extra that you bring to the game.
Now, you said that the story remains the same, no matter who's reporting it, and it's the seasoning, maybe, or the added details. How do you define what the story is? When do you capture a story? When do you recognize that you have gone out and all sorts of information, stimulation have been in front of you, but now you can say there's a story here?
You know, I should say that it's not that the story is always the story. Many stories, no matter who goes and does it, it's probably going to be pretty much the same. But there are some stories, the framing of which, those identities come very much into play. Because without them, you don't even realize there is a story. So you go to the assignment editor and you say, you know, we've been telling this story this way because it's sort of the default position narrative. But, you know, it's playing in different parts of town, in different parts of the country, in different parts of the polity, in a slightly different way because there are large numbers of Americans who see it this other way. It's bringing added intelligence that should inform the editorial decision-making that sometimes, and for a long time, was simply not there.
Walk me back to the moment in your childhood or in your youth where you recognized or came to terms with the fact that you wanted to tell stories as a journalist or as a broadcaster, when you came to understand that there's a narrative there in that it uses technology, the media. How did you become a journalist?
I came from a house where the radio was on a lot and heard people from all over the world talking about things that were happening, whether it was the final days of the Vietnam War or the opening salvos in what became the Watergate hearings or the Pope giving his greetings to the world on Easter morning. You know, there I was sitting in Brooklyn in a working class, very blue collar neighborhood and thinking, wow, you get to do that. And somebody pays you and you get to go to these places and see these things happening. It seemed like a pretty good way to go if you were interested in seeing the world, which I think I was, and if you thought that what you were good at was writing about things and talking about things, which by the time I was 13 or 14, I knew I was not going to be a Nobel Prize winning chemist. I knew I was not going to design the internet. I knew I was not going to find a new theorem in math, but I was pretty good at writing about things and talking about things. And I thought, well, all right, I don't want to have the financial struggles that my parents had. I think this is a pretty good way to earn a living. And let me pursue that. As I got older, I realized a lot of people didn't know what they wanted to do at 13, but I did and started setting my sails toward that goal.
When did you come to recognize that you were a Latino reporter, that your Latino background, your Puerto Rican background, was an essential or an important component of how you told your story?
That took some time only because I think I came up at a time when it was unclear how that was going to go. Was the model of acculturation going to be that everybody's just like everybody else, and that's the ideal? Or would I be seen by potential employers as that, whether I said anything, whether I did anything, whether I included it in my pitch or not? Was it an important part of how the world was going to regard me before I even cleared my throat to say anything? It turned out it was, and that dawned on me over time when I heard the questions that I would be asked by prospective employees, when I heard the queries from professors and teachers as I was coming up. And so this, a little bit of exclusion sets in as well. And you also realize, as you look at the TV and you listen to the radio, there are almost, certainly when I was a teenager, there were almost no Latino reporters in one of America's great Latino capitals. I mean, L.A., New York, Miami, Chicago, that's about it then, certainly. And yet, when I turned on the television, it's one thing if you were watching Spanish television, but if you were watching English language television, J.J. Gonzalez, Art Diaz, they were almost nobody. And so you realize, especially as you're getting more sophisticated, 16, 17, 18 years old, that you're going to be, whether you like it or not, walking into a profession where they're not used to having you around yet.
So have there been moments in which you didn't like this, that you felt caged, forced into this situation? Young people today stress the word represent. Forced to represent.
Sometimes that happens, and you don't want to carry the weight for the entire newsroom. And often when you're the only one, and in a lot of newsrooms in the 70s and 80s, I was the only one. And for that organization, often the first one. So you have to represent everything. You know, everything basically from the United States down to Tierra del Fuego, you have to be the guy who, the Latino whisperer, who explains everything, contextualizes everything, translates everything. It's a pain in the ass, but there it is. It's part of the unspoken job description that carries with you when you come through the door as the first or the only or one of the first. And it wasn't that I was unhappy about it. I bridled under that because if you're a careerist, in addition to being a Latino pioneer, whatever that is. But if you're a careerist, you want to do the lead story on that night's news. And the lead story is so rarely about those things into which you're being pigeonholed. Taco beat stuff, cultural representation stuff, ethnic parades, that you think, you know, I not only want to show that I can run with the big dogs and that I'm good at this, but I also want to make sure that representation is good. I want to make sure that the way Latinos end up on the air is just and fair and a rough representation of who they really are in this place. I was working in L.A., New York, and Chicago early in my career. And it's quite a juggling act where you're also thinking about down the road, what do I want to be doing when I'm 30, when I'm 40, when I'm 50? You don't want to be the guy who is the only guy who knows about these things. Yet, going over to the editor and whispering that Cinco de Mayo is not Mexican Independence Day, so let's change that in the copy before it goes on the air. Yeah, I mean, that's a useful thing. That's a good thing. I mean, there's no particular reason why I should know that, except that I do. But it's a handy thing. And then they'd look and say, huh, it's a handy thing to have that guy around. Because he kept us from making a mistake. So, you know what I mean? It's a kind of ambivalent thing where, yes, you want to show your people off. Why not? Right. But you also don't want to be confined by that.
I want to pursue that line of thought, but before I do that, Ray, I want to bring you back to growing up Puerto Rican in Brooklyn, growing up Mexican in Mexico. I don't remember thinking much about being Mexican. Everybody was Mexican. And it was only when I left Mexico, when I came to the United States as an immigrant, that I realized that I was Mexican. I sort of became Mexican in the United States. So I wonder if there was a transition for you, too, between how the house played with Puerto Rican culture, maybe I'm imagining here, in a way that was simply as part of the environment, but it was the outside that brought to you the category, the identity of being the Puerto Rican journalist or broadcaster?
In my case, it's a peculiar story. Not an unheard of one, but it has its own peculiarities because just before I started kindergarten, my parents moved from a part of Brooklyn where there were starting to be a lot of Puerto Ricans to a part of Brooklyn where there were none for the better schools. Mm-hmm. I grew up as the only one. So when you look at my class picture, class 1-1, my second grade class, class 2-1, that's it. It's me and 16 Jews and 16 Italians. And it's an interesting way to grow up because you are, I mean, what, you know, when you're 8, when you're 9, what do you think about? You think about, am I like these people? Am I not like these people? If I'm like them, when am I like them? How am I like them? My parents did this interesting thing where the threshold of our front door was an entry into a different world. And home culture was different, and the world outside was a different place. So we ate different food, and we knew different things, and we knew about different things, and that was just the way it was. And you just grow up with this dual notion of selfhood, and you compose yourself when you go out the door to be in a world where you're getting the second once over from top to bottom by your teachers, by principals, by people who are dying to demonstrate their liberalism by putting you out front in the class to show that they're being even-handed. It's a weird way to grow up. For the most part, it's fine, but it's a weird way to grow up.
And in what way was the Puerto Rican culture that you are describing, the one indoors, connected with the island, with Puerto Rican culture? And in what way it was the New Yorican culture or the mainland Puerto
both.
Rican?
It was both. It was only as I got older that I realized how both it was. Mm-hmm. Because when you grow up in a neighborhood with no Puerto Ricans in it and you go to other places to consume the outward physical signs of the culture, music, food, language, parades, your family, the rest of my extended family throughout the five boroughs. Puerto Rican-ness was something we had to travel to consume, travel to experience, or we had it inside the house. So every year at Christmas time, my father would go to a butcher and buy a suckling pig, and as is very much the custom among New Yorkers, he would go to a bakery to have it roasted, because obviously there was no place in our apartment building for us to have an open pit fire to slowly twirl this thing over the fire in preparation for Christmas. And then on Christmas Eve, we would throw open the doors and our neighbors would come in to consume an exotic Christmas Eve. And Trios Los Panchos would be playing in the background. And one of our Jewish neighbors would say, "Oh, is that Edie Gourmet?" And you'd say, "Yes, yes, it is Edie Gourmet." And it was a thing that we did with and for our neighbors that sort of dropped the veil a little bit so they could look over and see into our lives. And yet, when I talk with New Yorkers about that whole thing, about because only bakeries had an oven big enough to put an entire pig into. In our little apartments in Brooklyn, in tiny kitchens, we didn't have an oven where you could put in a whole pig. And we laugh our heads off because that's just an accepted part of the world. It's like being a saltwater fish swimming in salt water. You don't know it's there. Of course it's what everybody does, because who had an oven big enough? And we'd laugh because there's parts of life that are just common to us that we understand. When I became friendly over the years with Oscar Hijuelos, his father worked in hotels in New York, and my father worked in hotels in New York. He was a barber, and he had barbershops in New York hotels and then small tourist shops in New York hotels. And much like Disneyland, where there are hidden doors and portals and entry accesses, in a New York hotel, you are in the public open space where English is the language of everything that's going on around you. And then there'll be this little door that doesn't even really register. As you're looking around the lobby, you don't see this door. And then someone opens it and you realize, oh, there's a door there. Mm-hmm. Behind that door is an entire Spanish-speaking universe of janitors and porters and room service waiters and cooks and maintenance men and plumbers and barbers, as it happens. And we used to talk about that world and about how, like in Disneyland, cast members, Snow White, the Seven Dwarfs, Paul Bunyan, come out of a door and suddenly they're not employees of Disney Inc. anymore. They are the embodiment of this thing. Well, it happened in reverse in a New York hotel. You would be, however proficient you were in English, with the public and then move into an entire Spanish-speaking universe behind that hidden door. It is a world that other New Yorkers know nothing about. Know nothing about. And that's no knock on them. Why would they know anything about it? But it was a part of the secret knowledge that I've shared with people over the years where they say, yeah. You know, my father was a cook and they explain that. And it's like a little something like a club handshake, like a secret, a secret finger sign that we give each other.
How did we, the 60 million Latinos, become Latinos? In what way did you, as a Puerto Rican, become part of this large entity that both embraces the individuality of each of us, Puerto Rican, Cuban, Mexican, Dominican, and at the same time erases it? Does it make you uncomfortable? We've talked about discomfort before, that you sometimes can be identified as a Latino broadcaster or journalist rather than a Puerto Rican one. Are you comfortable with the term?
Well, I turned 60 in March, so if I wasn't comfortable with it yet, I mean, I'm kind of running out of time. As I moved out of New York into wider and wider circles in the country and got to experience more of life in the country, I started to understand this whole thing better. It starts out as very ethnically and nationally particular and very chauvinistic, your view of being a Latin American person in the United States. Certainly living in Los Angeles gave me another view on that. Living in Chicago, which is one of the few big metropolitan areas that has a mixed Latino population rather than one drawn primarily from one national origin, I started to see the emergence of a culture that was not of the countries of origin. A hybrid culture that was growing up stateside that could not exist back in the home countries of these people. For instance, when I first started to travel around the country as a young reporter, I knew when I got to the Southwest that I wouldn't hear Caribbean music on the radio, period. You got in your rental car, you turned on the radio, and you heard mostly Northern Mexican popular music and traditional music. Now, when you do that same exercise, you get in your rental at LAX and you turn on the radio in the rental car, you hear a little bit of everything. You hear Fania All-Stars, and you hear Juan Luis Guerra, and you hear, naturally, Vicente Fernandez and other people. But there is a thing now that wasn't there when I was a kid, where you'll say to somebody, well, tell me about your family. Where does it come from? And a young Latino will say, well, it's complicated. My mother's Ecuadorian and my father's Cuban. And I say, well, what do you think you are? And they'll say, a Latina, because that's a thing of here. Vicente Fernandez never went to New York because it was assumed who would go see him, because there were no Mexicans and people who were not Mexican were not interested in Mexican music. So therefore, there were no Dominicans in Chicago. Juan Luis Guerra and 440 didn't go there because why go there? There are no Dominicans. But of course, now we're in a world where Juan Luis Guerra sells out the Rosemont Horizon, which has like 16,000 seats, in a couple of hours. It doesn't matter that there are very few Dominicans in Chicago. He's part of a continental culture, a continental hybrid culture, where people don't say, oh, I can't listen to Juan Luis Guerra because I'm not Dominican. That would be ridiculous. No Dominican would say, oh, I can't listen to cumbia because I'm Dominican and cumbia's Colombian. That might have sounded normal in 1965. It might have sounded expected in 1965. In 2017, it just sounds dumb.
Often you get the sense that this abstraction, that is, we are all Latinos, we can listen to Juan Luis Guerra or to Vicente Fernandez, it hides the fact that there are lots of tensions within the Latino community. It is fractured. You can see on presidential elections or on state elections where Cubans will go in one direction and Puerto Ricans will go in another direction, or the Mexicans, depending on what the communities are there. When one talks about culture, it is comfortable in inviting to think that this larger abstraction, where all Latino, Ray Suarez is the Latino broadcaster or journalist, it makes us all happy. Here we have a representative. But we also are a type of culture that hides things under the rug. Often in the past presidential election, it was asked, would a Latino win the presidency? And the question was always also, which Latino? Is it a Cuban Latino? There were two Cuban Latinos in the 2016 election, no Mexican, no Puerto Rican. So there's a tension there between embrace and rejection.
I think you can overstate that. I understand your point entirely, and certainly when it comes to certain aspects of community life, it's true. There isn't a single view, but among any 60 million people, there isn't a single view of things. I think a substandard school in the LA Unified School District is not all that different from a substandard school in the South Bronx. Crappy housing in Miami-Dade is not all that different from crappy housing in the west side of Chicago. The issues that we deal with as a community, the issues that face us as a people, however oddly constituted we are as a people, they're similar. And when Raul Grijalva hits the pavement to work for workers' rights, he's embraced by Puerto Rican hotel workers in Chicago or Central American construction workers in Houston.
So you don't think we're a fractured minority?
Oh, sure. There are splits and tears, but in any community of 60 million people, there are splits and tears. Certainly there are going to be people say, well, you know, it's not as united as all of that. Look at the differences between Texas Mexicans and California Mexicans. And I say, oh, yeah, well, look at the difference between Texas and California. Texas Mexicans are more conservative because Texas is more conservative. California Mexicans are more liberal because California is more liberal. This is not really as National Geographic Margaret Meade as we want to make it. there are differences among Americans in different places. white people just assume that it's part of the air they breathe, and yet it's considered a big division among Latinos.
60 million is an enormous amount by any account, particularly when you see it in the context of the 450 million people that are part of the Hispanic world. That is, that they might be Spanish speakers or Portuguese speakers, but connect in one way or another with the Iberian Peninsula. And yet, going back to the early part of our conversation, you can count them with your hand, probably you would have fingers left, the journalists that are Latinos that are prominent in 2017. I would like to get your diagnosis of why we don't have more speakers, more diverse speakers, more complex voices out there in cable television, in public television, in radio, in other forms. We feel that at the local level, you will have all sorts of Latino reporters, but when making the jump to the national level, and let alone the international level, the numbers diminish dramatically.
Part of the problem is a problem of the business. So it's blinkered state, it's myopia, it's a narrow focus, creates a problem where if you are a commentator, an analyst, if you are a seasoned professional, it's likely you're only going to be asked to talk about a very narrow range of things, either immigration, bilingual education, or politics. It is hard to believe that in 2017, that state of affairs is allowed to prevail, yet there it is.
Why?
Because we are not seen, because of the myopia of the business, as people who are capable of discussing Middle East politics, military strategy, as the United States remains now well into the second decade involved in adventures in the Middle East and South Asia. We are considered just people that you have on when you have to, and just people that you have on to talk about things that are parochially and chauvinistically part of their lived experience.
And is it because we are waiting for others to allow us to engage in larger topics, or is it that we don't allow ourselves, that we don't have the traction, that we have not pushed also to open up those markets? Why is it in the landscape of diversity in the news industry, you could have African Americans that will be doing all sorts of jobs, but Latinos not so much. And other immigrants or other ethnic groups or minority groups also not so much.
You could watch MSNBC from the wee hours of the morning till late at night and not see
a single
Latino program host, not very prominent guests, except when they have to talk about immigration. You would never see, if the president is going to a NATO summit, somebody brought in to talk about the United States and NATO. I was talking to a friend who's an agent, and I said, you know, why is that? I don't think in this 21st century they would dare put on weeks of Meet the Press, This Week with George Stephanopoulos, Face the Nation, and not have a single black guest on, week in, week out, month in, month out. Why is that? How do they get away at Fox, at MSNBC, at CNN, with basically what the NAHJ, the National Association of Hispanic Journalists, calls a brownout? How do they do it? And he says, well, you know, nobody thinks they'll get in trouble if they don't hire you. If the business continued to treat black professionals that way, they would get in trouble, and they suspect that they would get in trouble.
But then it goes to the point that I was telling you. Is it that we don't cause the uproar that we should cause because we're not being hired? Let me put it from a different perspective, right? In the publishing industry, we used to complain a lot that there were not enough Latino voices or there were not enough diversity voices until we realized that it's less important what the name on the cover is than the editor who is going to acquire the book, who will have a sensibility to create a landscape where a Latino writer might fail or where a Latino writer can succeed, or we would have the capacity to be as mediocre as anybody else. That's the opportunity we would like.
People don't realize that that's a form of equality, too.
That's right.
Being able to be as mediocre as everybody
right.
else without the world being shaken to its foundation.
So is it that agents are not Latinos? Is it that editors are not Latinos?
Right.
That
it's the gatekeepers in these various manifestations of the business, whether it's assignment editors or executive producers or acquisitions editors at a publishing house. Yeah, the gatekeepers, they read census data just as well as anybody else, and they read sales figures just as well as anybody else. But they're also thinking about the angles. I have this limited number of chips on my side of the table. What am I going to spend them on? What am I going to bet on? So you wouldn't want the business to open its arms to 60 million customers and consumers in this continent because of fear, because they're afraid they'll be punished. You would want them to do it because they realize it's good business. It's good not only for their audiences who are like these people, their potential Latino audience, but it's also good news coverage to explain a growing, changing part of the American landscape to a general audience. Why not?
In the age where sexual harassment has become a major topic because of social media, because of the courage of women to use Twitter and Facebook and tell their stories in a way that when Anita Hill was in Washington, that was not the case. Is it also that we Latinos are too passive, that we don't scream and shout, that we don't use the social media to say this is not right? It's not only about presenting a story in a broader picture. It's about us saying we don't want the stories that are coming this particular way in the media.
It's funny, when you said that, I thought immediately of my parents, who were very hardworking people and took a lot of pride in doing a good job at what they were given to do. And when I had been passed over for a promotion at one of the places where I was working, I was just seething because I knew that because I didn't fit some prejudged ethnic slot, that instead of just seeing me for what I could do, they saw me for what I was, and I didn't get a promotion. And I said, you know, I have to sell myself differently inside this company. And that idea was really hard for them to take. My father said something like, your bosses know you're good at what you do. You will be recognized. And my mother said pretty much the same thing. Do good work. You don't toot your own horn. You don't brag about yourself. And there was a kind of innate modesty about the way they saw themselves in the world and the way they hoped others saw them. Their self-concept was built around not being showy, not being a showboat, but being someone who other people would look at and say, yes, Gloria, she's a good worker. Rafael, he's a good worker. And that's enough. They thought that that would be a terrible move for me to start blowing my own horn.
Are you telling me that you have paid the price for being nice?
Yeah, there's a price for being nice, absolutely. Because you aren't an irritant to sometimes the people that you have to irritate in order to move ahead. When faced with that choice, I always thought, look, at the end of the day, I have to own myself and I have to think I'm okay with me. And how much do I have to give away? How much do I have to transform in order to play this game as the game is being presented to me? And I always try to square that circle by saying, all right, who do I want to be at the end of the day? Promoted and a jerk, or owning myself and owning the way I want to be in the world and maybe missing out on that promotion?
So help me again, and at age 60, look back at the path that you've created, that others have seen you trace. You are frequently called a pioneer. You have been given honorary degrees for the role that you have played. Where have you come short? What have you not been able to achieve? What are your regrets?
Well, when I was being inducted into the Hall of Fame of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists, the woman who was giving the introductory remarks to my presentation said, it is a mystery to me why this man has not been snapped up by the networks. It was a mystery to me when he was a hot, aggressive, elbows out young reporter in Chicago decades ago, but it's a mystery to me now that he's a veteran correspondent. And I was sitting there at a proud moment to get up in front of an audience of your peers and be given a nice plaque and a lot of applause and all that and become a member of the Hall of Fame. And I thought, yeah, you know, why is that at long last? Why is that? I turn on the networks, and this isn't sour grapes. I mean, life is what it is. And I see people who can't write as well as I can. And I see people who can't speak as well as I can. And I see people without nearly the experience that I have. And I think, I don't get it. I still don't get it. I don't know what it is, but I've had some wonderful mountaintop experiences. I have had a career that I'm happy with and proud of. I have very few regrets, but I am sometimes puzzled. I'm a straight arrow. I'm not a guy who's telling one version of the story to one person and another person telling them something different because of office politics. I never wanted to play that game, and I never wanted to be that guy. And whether that hurt me or helped me, I don't know. But when I look at it all, there are things that don't add up to me, but I'll never know what the answer is, and I don't want to make myself crazy.
The one word that you have not used is biased. You are not describing yourself as someone who, having achieved as much as you have achieved as a Latino journalist and broadcaster, has also been impeded because he is a Latino broadcaster and journalist.
Part of that is self-protection. I don't want to end my working life. I've still got several more years to go, but I don't want to enter the last phase of my working life looking at the story of my career as one of victimhood. There are probably jobs that I was not considered for because of what I am, but there may have been jobs where it helped me get over the hump and get hired. I'll never know, and I'll never know the difference, and I'll never know which ones I didn't get. And so rather than make myself crazy about it, I'd rather just say, look, I had the run that I had. I did the best job I could wherever I went. And anybody who hired me, I gave them a good week's work for a good week's pay. And my hands are clean.
Do you have the impression that had you been born 20 years later or 30 years later, that your path would have been very different?
Absolutely. 20 years later, absolutely.
How so?
Because I look at network television now and all kinds of people who wouldn't have been hired 20 years ago are getting hired. And that's a great thing. And I see these wonderful young people working for the networks, working for CNN. And I know that these are jobs that I can no longer contend for because I've got gray in my temples and gray in my whiskers. And that's okay, too. I had what I had and I tried to play the hand that I had. I just don't want to dwell on this in a way that leaves me bitter and disappointed and angry. I got a chance to write 3 books. I got a chance to present national programs on radio and television, have a big following of people who liked what I was doing and read what I had to write and listened to what I had to say. And that's something that most people never even get close to having. So, you know, why make yourself crazy?
You have done a lot of TV and a lot of radio, too. We both know, you know far better than I do, that these are 2 very different forms of communication. Could you use certain adjectives to describe them as a way of comparison? What does one have that the other one doesn't, and vice versa?
Radio is very intimate. If you think about how you use the radio, more likely than not, you listen to the radio when you're by yourself, and you're engaged in a constant internal dialogue with people who can't hear you. They're talking at you in the car, in the kitchen, wherever you are, and you're answering them, and you're saying, oh, come on, or you're constantly playing off them. But really, it's a theater in between your ears where this whole drama is being performed. Television, you more likely watch with other people. And because of the added information of the visual, there is less of a creative act involved in watching TV because TV is giving you all that extra stuff that you may have been projecting on the screen inside your head when you were listening to the radio. And so you're doing the work of digesting, processing these images that are blinking past your eyeballs. You may be sitting with someone else on a couch saying, hey, look at that. Look at that person or look at that scene. Oh, my God, look at that devastated Houston street that's under 2 feet of water. Look at the terrible carnage in the scene of a mass killing. You're reactive. You are less creative because TV is presenting the things that you have to work a little harder to present to yourself when you're listening to the radio.
I want to spend the last few minutes talking about your language and your voice. Many of us recognize your voice. We don't have to see your face to know that it's you. How would you describe your voice?
I have very little sense of my voice being distinctive in any way. Mm. And people think that's false modesty. When they hear me say that, they say, oh, come on, or something like that. And I really have very little sense that I sound that different from any man who's on radio. But in fact, people tell me they'll hear me talking to my wife in a movie line, and they'll know it's me. I'll say to a bartender, can I have a, and I'll ask for something, and say, you're Ray Suarez. I have very little sense of being that recognizable, but as I get older and as I hear myself a little bit more, I think, oh, you know, that's a voice that cuts through. If there's anything that I think about my voice, it's probably that it can be heard. If you're listening to the radio and there's a lot of other things going on, you can still hear that voice coming out of the radio. It's not the deepest voice. It's not the highest voice. It's not a sort of James Earl Jonesian rumble in your chest. It's not Gilbert Gottfried's comedic stylings. I don't know what it is, but it's a voice I think that's very well suited for radio. I was listening, and I don't like doing radio interviews, in fact, but I was listening to an interview just the other day that the wonderful podcast host Jesse Thorne had done with me on the craft of interviewing. And I thought, yeah, you know, it's listenable. I guess it's welcoming. It's pleasant without being classical music station announcery. It's something that you can listen to for a little
There's
while.
There's one other element, Ray, and that is that you have a way of delivering your words, your sentences, that is very passionate, and it doesn't ever allow us to think this guy today is depressed, or this guy today got the best news. It's always in the same engaged, connected, embracing, warm way.
That's professional habit. You know, when you do a national radio show day in, day out, month in, month out, you can't be uneven unless it's that kind of show and your personal foibles, ups and downs is part of what you're trafficking in order to create a connection with your audience. But if you're doing the news, you should pretty much be even. Nobody should say, oh, he sounds like he's having a bad day.
In professionalism, does it mean that you can use your voice in such a way that you hide what is internally happening as well?
Sure, sure. That's professional habit as well, because you have to keep faith with the audience. When something is happening that you're covering that you think is a pretty darn good thing, the audience should have no sense of that. Neither should they have a sense when you're covering something that you think this is a terrible development. Bad for you, bad for the country, bad for the audience. That's just not a good way to proceed. Give them the information, let them use that information to do the work of being a citizen, but what you think about it is not really part of the whole thing.
Now let's go to your language. We just talked about your voice. If you were to listen to the Ray Suarez that started his career 30, 40 years ago, how did he use the English language that is different from the Ray Suarez that is 60, that is using the English language today? Let me add one element here. As a listener and as a person that has followed your career, you have a capacity almost of shaping sentences that give the audience the impression that they are dictated, that they are perfectly balanced. When one uses oral language, sometimes one gets caught in the middle of a sentence and doesn't put the verb or forgets about the adjective. But in you, it's almost as if it could be transcribed already. How did you come to shape the language that way? And were you conscious of this development?
There have been times when I've done live broadcasts, which are totally without a script, just right out of my head, through my larynx, into the microphone and into your ear. And bosses have said to me, you know, I wanted something a little bit more spontaneous. I didn't want something scripted. And I say, I didn't have a script. I was just watching this event and describing what was happening. And they say, really, that wasn't scripted? And I say, yeah, because, you know, just fluid. I'm fluid. So I look at something and I can describe it.
Have you always been fluid this way? Has that come with age, with the professionalism?
I mean, I think I'm better at it. Even when I went on the air at WNYU-FM at New York University at 18, I was pretty good at it already. Certainly over the years, you pick up a few tricks and you get more confident in what your act is. But I've been always a good talker, and that helped lead me to do this for a living.
Could there be also that you are using such sophisticated vocabulary, so syntactical a structure in your sentences, that you might alienate an audience in a country where intellectualism is seen with suspicion, where being too formal in the way we speak puts you into a certain elite or into a certain social context?
Well, maybe the idea of welcome and warmth compensates in part for that. You're welcoming people into your realm when you're asking them to listen to you on the radio, and you have to be a good host once they're there, not alienate them, but also not talk down to them. And you have choices to make, certainly, when you're doing that. You can't use word choice that is so self-conscious that you're, in effect, winking at them and saying, hey, I'm smarter than you. That would be bad. But, you know, it may be, Ilan, that I didn't feel that I had the leeway to be as informal as other people, because when you are on the front edge of a group, and I'll bet black professionals who went into the newsroom 15, 16, 17 years before I did would tell you some of the same stories. You don't have the luxury of informality that they have, because you have to prove that you belong there, prove that you speak the King's right. English, and prove that you not only are good at the things you know and they expect you to know, but also know the things that they know, so that you have a common currency. It is a difficult set of steps to walk in, like those old Arthur Murray dance studios with the footsteps on the floor. You are an avatar for a people, which has its ups and its downs, but I think certainly you can't be nonchalant in quite the same way.
By way of conclusion, you talked a little while ago about the next few years that you hope you have in broadcasting and in journalism. If you had the deck that you wish, how would you spend those years? In what way would they be what you have been doing? In what way would they be different from what you've been doing?
If I were to sketch out the next 10 years, let's say, what I would like to do ideally is get back on the air, either in radio or television, do that hard at it, you know, running hard for another 6 or 7 years. And then start to taper off more to writing, lecturing, teaching, but still working. I can't imagine myself not working at all. To me, the luxury in life would be to choose how hard to work, to choose how much to work, not whether or not to work, because I'll always work, but it would be so cushy to be able to say, you know, I'm going to take these months off, do this thing that interests me, and then work for 3 or 4 months straight. After that, I think life is lining up in a way that there will be good opportunities down the road for me. I'm shooting for 68, 69, 70 to sort of say, all right, I'm tapering off, stepping back, doing a little less, because I've never worked a 40-hour week in my life until now, being a college professor. My whole life before that was really running, running, running. If you talk to my kids who are now adults, they would say, when he was with us, he was really with us and he was present, but boy, he worked a lot. And I think I've put in my time. I've punched my clock.
It's been such a pleasure. It has been incredibly enlightening to have you in the show. Thank you, Ray Suarez.
Thanks for inviting me, Ilan.
A healthy news media is a media that endorses impartiality. Ideally, we want our reporters to be objective, to look at the story from multiple perspectives, or at the very least, to give the pros and cons about it. Impartiality has taken a leave of absence in American reporting. The news ecosystem we have is divided across ideological lines. Audiences subscribe to programs based on their political bent. This is troublesome. Though it looks extinct, there is such a thing as truth. Truth, which is unbiased, unprejudiced, neutral. In a diverse, multicultural, pluralistic society, we want our media to reflect who we are. Not only what we think, but how we look. We want Blacks, Latinos, Asian, women, and the LGBT community not only to be recipients of the news, but providers of it as well. It would be foolish to think this is about quotas. Instead, it is about making sure we are all in this together. It is about acknowledging that the act of telling a story entails control of it. And control of a story is control of power. To deliver a story is to share the control of how the narrative of society is shaped. We are far from where we need to be in this regard. While America is becoming more diverse by the day, one wouldn't know it from watching TV, listening to the voices on the radio, or reading the bylines in newspapers. A broadcaster who is female or Latino doesn't favor a particular side of a story. Yet the fact that the story comes to us from such a source has the potential to make our perspective on things wider and more nuanced. And nuance is crucial for a news media to live up to its mission of being the fourth estate, being independent, open-minded, and equitable. It is a challenge to be the only minority reporter or broadcaster in a newsroom. The pressure is immense. You stop being a person and become a symbol. It isn't good for that individual. It's worse for the newsroom, and it's bad for the culture at large. The viewpoint that results is narrow, insufficient, impoverishing. The argument against diversity in the news and entertainment industry is often, but that's what the public wants to see. Wrong. Audiences are brave, active, and adventurous. But even if the argument was right, why give the audience what it wants? Why not make the audience want something different that is open-minded? The news media is like a mirror. We are not passive consumers. We are its producers, its makers. Our faces are on the mirror. Yes, it is us who are on the screen, behind the microphone, typing the words that end up printed on the page. We get the news media we deserve. For that reason alone, we should demand more of it. We should demand the world. Next time on In Contrast.
It essentially revs up your immune system. They're trying to get as many white blood cell antibodies in you to rev up your immune system to kill the cancer cells.
Exploring cutting-edge cancer therapy with Peter Rooney on the next In Contrast. Let us know what you think about In Contrast. Review us on Apple Podcasts or send us an email to radio@nepr.net. You can also follow us on Facebook, where we invite you to share your comments on this program and others in our series. Our interns include Isabel Myers, Jacob Pagano, Ian Petty, Ushi Shao, and Brian Torres. Our music is by the Fresh Cut Orchestra. The executive producer of In Contrast is John Vosey. I'm Ilan Stavans. Thank you for listening. In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio and Quixote Productions.